Chapter 22. General Kelly. On August 4th, the president and key members of the West Wing left for Trump's golf club in Bedminster. The new chief of staff, General Kelly, was in tow, but the president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, had been left behind. Trump was grouchy about the planned 17-day trip, bothered by how diligently his golf dates were being clocked by the media. So this was now dubbed a working trip, another piece of Trump vanity that drew shrugs, eye-rolling, and head-shaking from a staff that had been charged with planning events that looked like work even if they were instructed to leave yawning expanses of time for golf. During the president's absence, the West Wing would be renovated. Trump, the hotelier and decorator, was disgusted by its condition. The president did not want to move over to the nearby executive office building where the West Wing business would temporarily be conducted, and where Steve Bannon sat waiting for his call to go to Bedminster. He was about to leave for Bedminster, Bannon kept telling everyone, but no invitation came. Bannon, who claimed credit for bringing Kelly into the administration in the first place, was unsure where he stood with the new chief. Indeed, the president himself was unsure about where he himself stood. He kept asking people if Kelly liked him. More generally, Bannon wasn't entirely clear what Kelly was doing, other than his duty. Where exactly did the new chief of staff fit in Trump world? While Kelly stood somewhere right of center on the political spectrum, and had been a willing, tough immigration enforcer at Homeland Security, he was not anywhere near so right as Bannon or Trump. "He's not hardcore," was Bannon's regretful appraisal. At the same time, Kelly was certainly not close in any way to the New York liberals in the White House. But politics was not his purview. As director of Homeland Security, he had watched the chaos in the White House with disgust and thought about quitting. Now he had agreed to try to tame it. He was 67, resolute, stern, and grim. "Does he ever smile?" asked Trump, who had already begun to think he had somehow been tricked into the hire. Some Trumpers, particularly those with over-the-transom access to the president, believed that he had been tricked into some form of very-much-not-Trump submission. Roger Stone, one of those people whose calls Kelly was now shielding the president from, spread the dark scenario that Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly had agreed that no military action would ever be taken unless the three were in accord, and that at least one of them would always remain in Washington if the others were away. After Kelly dispatched Scaramucci, his two immediate issues, now on the table in Bedminster, were the president's relatives and Steve Bannon. One side or the other obviously had to go. Or perhaps both should go. It was far from clear whether a White House chief of staff who saw his function as establishing command process and enforcing organizational hierarchy, directing a decision funnel to the commander-in-chief, could operate effectively or even exist in a White House where the commander-in-chief's children had special access and overriding influence. As much as the president's daughter and son-in-law were now offering slavish regard for the new command principles, they would, surely by habit and temperament, override Kelly's control of the West Wing. Not only did they have obvious special influence with the president, but important members of the staff saw them as having this juice and hence believed that they were the true north of West Wing advancement and power. Curiously, for all their callowness, Jared and Ivanka had become quite a fearsome presence, as feared by others as the two of them feared Bannon. What's more, they had become quite accomplished infighters and leakers. They had front room and back channel power. Although, with great woundedness, they insisted incredibly that they never leaked. If they hear someone talking about them because they are so careful about their image and have crafted this whole persona, it's like anyone who tries to pierce it or say something against it, it is like a big problem, said one senior staffer. They get very upset and will come after you. On the other hand, while the kids might make Kelly's job all but impossible, keeping Bannon on board didn't make a lot of sense either. Whatever his gifts, he was a hopeless plotter and malcontent, bound to do an end run around any organization. Besides, as the Bedminster hiatus, working or otherwise, began, Bannon was once more on the president's shit list. The president continued to stew about The Devil's Bargain, the book by Joshua Green that gave Bannon credit for the election. Then, too, while the president tended to side with Bannon against McMaster, the campaign to defend McMaster, supported by Jared and Ivanka, was having an effect. Murdoch, enlisted by Jared to help defend McMaster, was personally lobbying the president for Bannon's head. Bannonites felt they had to defend Bannon against an impulsive move by the president, so now, not only did they brand McMaster as weak on Israel, they persuaded Sheldon Adelson to lobby Trump. Bannon, Adelson told the president, was the only person he trusted on Israel in the White House. Adelson's billions and implacability always impressed Trump, and his endorsement, Bannon believed, significantly strengthened his hand. But overriding the management of the harrowing West Wing dysfunction, Kelly's success, or even relevance, as he was informed by almost anyone who was in a position to offer him an opinion, depended on his rising to the central challenge of his job, which was how to manage Trump. Or actually, how to live with not managing him. His desires, needs, and impulses had to exist, necessarily had to exist, outside the organizational structure. Trump was the one variable that, in management terms, simply could not be controlled. He was like a recalcitrant 2-year-old. If you tried to control him, it would only have the opposite effect. In this, then, the manager had to most firmly manage his own expectations. In an early meeting with the president, General Kelly had Jared and Ivanka on his agenda, how the president saw their role, what he thought was working and not working about it, how he envisioned it going forward. It was all intended to be a politic way of opening a discussion about getting them out. But the president was, Kelly soon learned, delighted with all aspects of their performance in the West Wing. Maybe at some point Jared would become Secretary of State. That was the only change the president seemed to foresee. The most Kelly could do was to get the president to acknowledge that the couple should be part of a greater organizational discipline in the West Wing and should not so readily jump the line. This, at least, was something that the general could try to enforce. At a dinner in Bedminster, the president dining with his daughter and son-in-law, the first family were confused when Kelly showed up at the meal and joined them. This, they shortly came to understand, was neither an attempt at pleasant socializing nor an instance of unwarranted overfamiliarity. It was enforcement. Jared and Ivanka needed to go through him to talk to the president. But Trump had made clear his feelings that the roles played by the kids in his administration needed only minor adjustment, and this now presented a significant problem for Bannon. Bannon really had believed that Kelly would find a way to send Jervanka home. How could he not? Indeed, Bannon had convinced himself that they represented the largest danger to Trump. They would take the president down. As much, Bannon believed that he could not remain in the White House if they did. Beyond Trump's current irritation with Bannon, which many believed was just the usual constant of Trump resentment and complaint, Bannonites felt that their leader had, at least policy-wise, gained the upper hand. Jervanka was marginalized. The Republican leadership, after health care, was discredited. The Cohn-Mnuchin tax plan was a hash. Through one window, the future looked almost rosy for Bannon. Sam Nunberg, the former Trump loyalist who was now wholly a Bannon loyalist, believed that Bannon would stay in the White House for 2 years and then leave to run Trump's re-election campaign. "If you can get this idiot elected twice," Nunberg marveled, "you would achieve something like immortality in politics." But through another window, Bannon couldn't possibly remain in place. He seemed to have moved into a heightened state that allowed him to see just how ridiculous the White House had become. He could barely hold his tongue. Indeed, he couldn't hold it. Pressed, he could not see the future of the Trump administration. And while many Bannonites argued the case for Jervanka ineffectiveness and irrelevance, just ignore them, they said, Bannon, with mounting ferocity and public venom, could abide them less and less every day. Bannon, continuing to wait for his call to join the president in Bedminster, decided that he would force the situation and offered his resignation to Kelly. But this was in fact a game of chicken. He wanted to stay. On the other hand, he wanted Jervanka to go. And that became an effective ultimatum. At lunch on August 8th, in the clubhouse at Bedminster, amid Trumpish chandeliers, golf trophies, and tournament plaques, the president was flanked by Tom Price, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and his wife, Melania. Kellyanne Conway was at the lunch. So were Kushner and several others. This was one of the make-work events. Over lunch, there was a discussion of the opioid crisis, which was then followed by a statement from the president and a brief round of questions from reporters. While reading the statement in a monotone, Trump kept his head down, propping it on his elbows. After taking some humdrum questions about opioids, he was suddenly asked about North Korea, and quite as though in stop-action animation, he seemed to come alive. North Korea had been a heavy-on-detail, short-on-answers problem that he believed was the product of lesser minds and weaker resolve, and that he had trouble paying attention to. What's more, he had increasingly personalized his antagonism with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, referring to him often with derogatory epithets. His staff had not prepared him for this, but, in apparent relief that he could digress from the opioid discussion, as well as sudden satisfaction at the opportunity to address this nagging problem, he ventured out in language that he'd repeated often in private, as he repeated everything often, to the precipice of an international crisis. North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with the fire and the fury the like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal state, and as I said, they will be met with fire and fury and, frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you. North Korea, a situation the president had been consistently advised to downplay, now became the central subject of the rest of the week, with most senior staff occupied not so much by the topic itself, but by how to respond to the president, who was threatening to blow again. Against this background, almost no one paid attention to the announcement by the Trump supporter and American neo-Nazi Richard Spencer that he was organizing a protest at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville over the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. Unite the Right, the theme of the rally called for Saturday, August 12th, was explicitly designed to link Trump's politics with white nationalism. On August 11th, with the president in Bedminster continuing to threaten North Korea, and also, inexplicably to almost everyone on his staff, threatening military intervention in Venezuela, Spencer called for an evening protest. At 8:45 p.m., with the president in for the night in Bedminster, about 250 young men dressed in khaki pants and polo shirts, quite a Trump style of dress, began an organized parade across the UVA campus while carrying kerosene torches. Parade monitors with headsets directed the scene. At a signal, the marchers began chanting official movement slogans: Blood and Soil, You Will Not Replace Us, Jews Will Not Replace Us. Soon, at the center of campus, near a statue of UVA's founder, Thomas Jefferson, Spencer's group was met by a counter-protest. With virtually no police presence, the first of the weekend's melees and injuries ensued. Beginning again at 8 o'clock the next morning, the park near the Lee statue became the battleground of a suddenly surging white racist movement, with clubs, shields, mace, pistols, and automatic rifles. Virginia is an open-carry state. A movement seemingly, and to liberal horror, born out of the Trump campaign and election, as in fact Richard Spencer intended it to seem. Opposing the demonstrators was a hardened, militant left called to the barricades. You could hardly have better set an end-time scene, no matter the limited numbers of protesters. Much of the morning involved a series of charges and countercharges, a rocks-and-bottles combat, with a seemingly hands-off police force standing by. In Bedminster, there was still little awareness of the unfolding events in Charlottesville. But then, at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, James Alex Fields Jr., a 20-year-old would-be Nazi, plunged his Dodge Charger into a group of counter-protesters, killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer and injuring a score of others. In a tweet hurriedly composed by his staff the president declared, "We all must be united and condemn all that hate stands for. There is no place for this kind of violence in America. Let's come together as one." Otherwise, however, it was largely business as usual for the president. Charlottesville was a mere distraction, and indeed, the staff's goal was to keep him off North Korea. The main event in Bedminster that day was the ceremonial signing of an act extending the funding of a program that let veterans obtain medical care outside VA hospitals. The signing was held in a big ballroom at the clubhouse 2 hours after Alex Field's attack. During the signing, Trump took a moment to condemn the hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides in Charlottesville. Almost immediately, the president came under attack for the distinction he had appeared to refuse to draw between avowed racists and the other side. As Richard Spencer had correctly understood, the president's sympathies were muddled. However easy and obvious it was to condemn white racists, even self-styled neo-Nazis, he instinctively resisted. It wasn't until the next morning that the White House finally tried to clarify Trump's position with a formal statement. The president said very strongly in his statement yesterday that he condemns all forms of violence, bigotry, and hatred. Of course, that includes white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazi, and all extremist groups. He called for national unity and bringing all Americans together. But in fact, he hadn't condemned white supremacists, KKK, and neo-Nazis, and he continued to be stubborn about not doing it. In a call to Bannon, Trump sought help making his case. Where does this all end? Are they going to take down the Washington Monument, Mount Rushmore, Mount Vernon? Bannon, still not receiving his summons to Bedminster, urged this to be the line. The president should condemn violence and misfits and also defend history, even with Trump's weak grasp of it. Stressing the literal issue of monuments would bedevil the left and comfort the right. But Jared and Ivanka, with Kelly backing them, urged presidential behavior. Their plan was to have Trump return to the White House and address the issue with a forceful censure of hate groups and racial politics. Exactly the unambiguous sort of position Richard Spencer has strategically bet Trump would not willingly take. Bannon, understanding these same currents in Trump, lobbied Kelly and told him that the Jervanka approach would backfire. "It will be clear his heart's not in it," said Bannon. The president arrived shortly before 11 o'clock on Monday morning at a White House under construction and a wall of shouted questions about Charlottesville. "Do you condemn the actions of neo-Nazis? Do you condemn the actions of white supremacists?" Some 90 minutes later, he stood in the diplomatic reception room, his eyes locked onto the teleprompter, and delivered a 6-minute statement. Before getting to the point, "Our economy is now strong. The stock market continues to hit record highs. Unemployment is at a 16-year low, and businesses are more optimistic than ever before. Companies are moving back to the United States and bringing many thousands of jobs with them. We have already created over 1 million jobs since I took office." And only then, "We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans." It was a reluctant mini-grovel. It was something of a restaging of the Take It Back Birther speech about Obama during the campaign. Much distraction and obfuscation, then a mumbled acknowledgement. Similarly, he looked here, trying to toe the accepted line on Charlottesville, like a kid called on the carpet, resentful and petulant. He was clearly reading forced lines. And in fact, he got little credit for these presidential-style remarks, with reporters shouting questions about why it had taken him so long to address the issue. As he got back on Marine One to head to Andrews Air Force Base and on to JFK and then into Manhattan and Trump Tower, his mood was dark and "I told you so." Privately, he kept trying to rationalize why someone would be a member of the KKK. That is, they might not actually believe what the KKK believed, and the KKK probably does not believe what it used to believe. And anyway, who really knows what the KKK believes now? In fact, he said his own father was accused of being involved with the KKK. Not true. In fact, yes, true. The next day, Tuesday, August 15th, the White House had a news conference scheduled at Trump Tower. Bannon urged Kelly to cancel it. It was a nothing conference anyway. Its premise was about infrastructure, about undoing an environmental regulation that could help get projects started faster. But it was really just another effort to show that Trump was working, and not just on holiday. So why bother? What's more, Bannon told Kelly, he could see the signs. The arrow on the Trump pressure cooker was climbing, and before long he'd blow. The news conference went ahead anyway. Standing at the lectern in the lobby of Trump Tower, the president stayed on script for mere minutes. Defensive and self-justifying, he staked out a contrition is bunk, the fault lies everywhere else position, and then dug in deep. He went on without an evident ability to adjust his emotions to political circumstance, or really even to make an effort to save himself. It was yet one more example among his many now of the comic absurd, movie-like politician who just says whatever is on his mind, unmediated, crazy-like. What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? What about the fact they came charging with clubs in their hands? As far as I'm concerned, that was a horrible, horrible day. I think there's blame on both sides. I have no doubt about it. You don't have any doubt about it. If you reported it accurately, you would see. Steve Bannon, still waiting in his temporary office in the EOB, thought, "Oh my God, there he goes. I told you so." Outside of the portion of the electorate that, as Trump once claimed, would let him shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, the civilized world was pretty much universally aghast. Everybody came to a dumbfounded moral attention. Anybody in any position of responsibility remotely tied to some idea of establishment respectability had to disavow him. Every CEO of a public company who had associated him or herself with the Trump White House now needed to cut the ties. The overriding issue might not even be what unreconstructed sentiments he actually seemed to hold in his heart. Bannon averred that Trump was not, in fact, anti-Semitic, but on the other count, he wasn't sure, but that he flat out couldn't control himself. In the wake of the immolating news conference, all eyes were suddenly on Kelly. This was his baptism of Trump fire. Spicer, Priebus, Cohn, Powell, Bannon, Tillerson, Mattis, Mnuchin, virtually the entire senior staff and cabinet of the Trump presidency, past and present, had traveled through the stages of adventure, challenge, frustration, battle, self-justification, and doubt, before finally having to confront the very real likelihood that the president they worked for, whose presidency they bore some official responsibility for, didn't have the wherewithal to adequately function in his job. Now, after less than 2 weeks on the job, it was Kelly's turn to stand at that precipice. The debate, as Bannon put it, was not about whether the president's situation was bad, but whether it was 25th Amendment bad. To Bannon, if not to Trump, the linchpin of Trumpism was China. The story of the next generation, he believed, had been written, and it was about war with China. Commercial war, trade war, cultural war, diplomatic war. It would be an all-encompassing war that few in the United States now understood needed to be fought, and that almost nobody was prepared to fight. Bannon had compiled a list of China hawks that crossed political lines, going from the Breitbart gang to former New Republic editor Peter Beinart, who regarded Bannon only with scorn, and orthodox liberal progressive stalwart Robert Kuttner, the editor of the small public policy magazine American Prospect. On Wednesday, August 16th, the day after the president's news conference in Trump Tower, Bannon, out of the blue, called Kuttner from his EOB office to talk China. By this point, Bannon was all but convinced that he was on the way out of the White House. He had received no invitation to join the president in Bedminster, a withering sign. That day, he had learned of the appointment of Hope Hicks as interim communications director, a Jerevanka victory. Meanwhile, the steady whisper from the Jerevanka side continued about his certain demise. It had become a constant background noise. He was still not sure he would be fired. Yet Bannon, in only the second on-the-record interview he had given since the Trump victory, called Kuttner and, in effect, sealed his fate. He would later maintain that the conversation was not on the record, but this was the Bannon method, in which he merely tempted fate. If Trump was helplessly Trump in his most recent news conference, Bannon was helplessly Bannon in his chat with Kuttner. He tried to prop up what he made sound like a weak Trump on China. He corrected, in mocking fashion, the president's bluster on North Korea. 10 million people in Seoul will die, he declared, and he insulted his internal enemies. They're wetting themselves. If Trump was incapable of sounding like a president, Bannon had matched him. He was incapable of sounding like a presidential aide. That evening, a group of Bannonites gathered near the White House for dinner. The dinner was called for the bar at the Hay Adams Hotel, but Arthur Schwartz, a Bannonite PR man, got into an altercation with the Hay Adams bartender about switching the television from CNN to Fox, where his client, Blackstone's Stephen Schwartzman, the chairman of one of the president's business councils, was shortly to appear. The business council was hemorrhaging its CEO members after the president's Charlottesville news conference, and Trump, in a tweet, had announced that he was disbanding it. Schwartzman had advised the president that the council was collapsing and that the president ought to at least make it look as if shutting it down was his decision. Schwartz, in high dudgeon, announced that he was checking out of the Hay Adams and moving to the Trump Hotel. He also insisted that the dinner be moved 2 blocks away to Joe's, an outpost of Miami Joe's Stone Crab. Matthew Boyle, the Washington political editor of Breitbart News, was swept into Schwartz's furious departure, with Schwartz upbraiding the 29-year-old for lighting a cigarette. "I don't know anyone who smokes," he sniffed. Although Schwartz was firmly in the Bannon camp, this seemed to be a general dig at the Breitbart people for being low class. Both dedicated Bannonites debated the effect of Bannon's interview, which had caught everybody in the Bannon universe off guard. Neither man could understand why he would have given an interview. Was Bannon finished? No, argued Schwartz. He might have been a few weeks ago, when Murdoch had ganged up with McMaster and gone to the president and pressed him to dump Bannon, but then Sheldon had fixed it, Schwartz said. Steve stayed home when a boss came, said Schwartz. He wasn't going to breathe the air that a terrorist breathed. This was the precise line Schwartz would hand out to reporters in the coming days in a further effort to establish Bannon's right-wing virtue. Alexander Preet, Bannon's lieutenant, arrived at Joe's out of breath. Seconds later, Jason Miller, another PR man in the Bannon fold, arrived. During the transition, Miller had been slated to be the communications director, but then it had come out that Miller had had a relationship with another staff member who announced in a tweet she was pregnant by Miller, as was also, at this point, Miller's wife. Miller, who had lost his promised White House job but continued serving as an outside Trump and Bannon voice, was now, with the recent birth of the child, within the recent birth of both his children by different women, facing another wave of difficult press. Still, even he was obsessively focused on what Bannon's interview might mean. By now, the table was buzzing with speculation. How would the president react? How would Kelly react? Was this curtains? For a group of people in touch with Bannon on an almost moment-by-moment basis, it was remarkable that nobody seemed to understand that, forcibly or otherwise, he would surely be moving out of the White House. On the contrary, the damaging interview was, by consensus, converted into a brilliant strategic move. Bannon was not going anywhere, not least because there was no Trump without Bannon. It was an excited dinner, a revved-up occasion involving a passionate group of people all attached to the man who they believed was the most compelling figure in Washington. They saw him as some sort of irreducible element. Bannon was Bannon was Bannon. As the evening went on, Matt Boyle got in a furious text message fight with Jonathan Swan, a White House reporter who had written a story about Bannon being on the losing side in the Bannon-McMaster showdown. Soon, almost every well-connected reporter in the city was checking in with somebody at the table. When a text came in, the recipient would hold up his or her phone if it showed a notable reporter's name. At one point, Bannon texted Schwartz some talking points. Could it be that this was just one more day in the endless Trump drama? Schwartz, who seemed to regard Trump's stupidity as a political given, offered a vigorous analysis of why Trump could not do without Bannon. Then, seeking more proof of his theory, Schwartz said he was texting Sam Nunberg, generally regarded as the man who understood Trump's whims and impulses best, and who had sagely predicted Bannon's survival at each doubtful moment in the past months. "Nunberg always knows," said Schwartz. Seconds later, Schwartz looked up. His eyes widened, and for a moment he went silent. Then he said, "Nunberg says Bannon's dead." And indeed, unbeknownst to the Bannonites, even those closest to him, Bannon was at that moment finalizing his exit with Kelly. By the next day, he would be packing up his little office, and on Monday, when Trump would return to a refurbished West Wing, a paint job, new furniture, new rugs, its look tilting toward the Trump Hotel, Steve Bannon would be back on Capitol Hill at the Breitbart Embassy. Still, he was confident, the chief strategist for the Trump Revolution.